This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Crooked Kingdom, written by Leigh Bardugo, performed by Kevin T. Collins, Peter Ganim, Lauren Fortgang, Elizabeth Evans, Jay Snyder, Brandon Rubin, Roger Clark, and Fred Berman.
Part 1. Forsaken.
Chapter 1. Redvenko. Redvenko leaned against the bar and tucked his nose into his dirty shot glass. The whiskey had failed to warm him. Nothing could get you warm in this saints-forsaken city, and there was no escaping the smell, the throat-choking stew of bilge, clams, and wet stone that seemed to have soaked into his pores as if he'd been steeping in the city's essence like the world's worst cup of tea. It was most noticeable in the barrel, even more so in a miserable dump like this one, a squat tavern wedged into the lower floor of one of the slum's grimmest apartment buildings, its ceiling bowed by weather and shoddy construction, its beams blackened by soot from a fireplace that had long since ceased to function, the flue clogged by debris. The floor was covered in sawdust to soak up spilled lager, vomit, and whatever else the bar's patrons lost control of. Redvenko wondered how long it had been since the boards had been swept clean. He buried his nose more deeply in the glass, inhaling the sweet perfume of bad whiskey. It made his eyes water. "You're supposed to drink it, not snort it," said the barkeep with a laugh. Redvenko put his glass down and gazed at the man blearily. He was thick-necked and barrel-chested, a real bruiser. Redvenko had seen him toss more than one rowdy patron into the street, but it was hard to take him seriously dressed in the absurd fashion favored by the young men of the barrel, a pink shirt with sleeves that looked fit to split over huge biceps, a garish red and orange plaid waistcoat. He looked like a dandified softshell crab. "Tell me," said Redvenko. His courage wasn't good to begin with, and it was worse after a few drinks. "Why does city smell so bad, like old soup, like sink full of dishes?" The barman laughed. "That's just Ketterdam. You get used to it." Redvenko shook his head. He didn't want to get used to this city or its stink. His job with Councilman Hode had been dull, but at least his rooms had been dry and warm. As a treasured Grisha indenture, Redvenko had been kept in comfort, his belly full. He'd cursed Hode at the time, bored with his work shepherding the merchant's expensive cargo shipments across the sea, resenting the terms of his contract, the foolish bargain he'd made to get himself out of Ravka after the Civil War. But now... now he couldn't help thinking of the Grisha workshop at Hode's house, the fire burning merrily in the grate, brown bread served with slabs of butter and thick cuts of ham. After Hode had died, the Kerch Merchant Council had let Redvenko take on sea voyages to pay his way out of the indenture. The money was terrible, but what other options did he have? He was a Grisha squalor in a hostile city with no skills but the gifts with which he'd been born. "Another?" the barman asked, gesturing at Redvenko's empty glass. Redvenko hesitated. He shouldn't waste his money. If he was smart with his pennies, he would only need to rent himself out for one more voyage, maybe two, and he'd have enough money to pay off his indenture and buy himself a ticket to Ravka in a third-class berth. That was all he needed. He was due on the docks in less than an hour. Storms had been predicted, so the crew would rely on Redvenko to master the air currents and guide the ship calmly to whatever port they needed to reach. He didn't know where, and he didn't care. The captain would call coordinates, Redvenko would fill the sails or calm the skies, and then he would collect his pay. But the winds hadn't picked up yet. Maybe he could sleep through the first part of the voyage. Redvenko tapped the bar and nodded. What was a man to do? He deserved some comfort in this world.
I am not errand boy, he muttered.
What's that? The barman asked as he poured out another drink. Redvenko gave a dismissive wave. This person, this common lout, could never understand. He toiled away in obscurity, hoping for what? An extra coin in his pocket? A warm glance from a pretty girl? He knew nothing of glory in battle, what it was to be revered. Yurovkin? Through the muzzy blur the whiskey had created, Retvenko came alert.
Why?
No reason. You just sound Ravkin. Retvenko told himself to relax. Plenty of Ravkins came through Ketterdam looking for work. There was nothing on him that said Grisha. His cowardice filled him with disgust. At himself, the barman, this city. He wanted to sit and enjoy his drink. There was no one in the bar to jump him, and despite the barman's muscles, Redvenko knew he could handle him easily. But when you were Grisha, even staying still could mean courting trouble. There had been more rumors of disappearances in Ketterdam recently, Grisha vanishing from the streets or their homes, probably snapped up by slavers and sold to the highest bidder. Redvenko would not let that happen to him. Not when he was so close to buying his way back to Ravka. He downed his whiskey, slammed a coin on the counter, and rose from the barstool. He left no tip. A man could work for a living. Redvenko felt a little unsteady as he headed outside, and the moist stink of the air didn't help. He put his head down and set his feet toward Fourth Harbor, letting the walk clear his head. Two more voyages, he repeated to himself. A few more weeks at sea, a few more months in this city. He'd find a way to make it bearable. He wondered if some of his old friends might be waiting for him in Ravka. The young king was said to be handing out pardons like penny candy, eager to rebuild the Second Army, the Grisha military that had been decimated by the war.
Just two more trips, he said to no one, stamping his boots against the spring damp. How could it be this cold and wet this late in the year? Living in this city was like being trapped in the chilly armpit of a frost giant.
He passed along Grafkanal, shivering as he glimpsed Black Veil Island tucked into the water's bend. That was where the Kirch wealthy had once buried their dead, in little stone houses above water level. Some trick of the climate kept the island shrouded in shifting mists, and there were rumors that the place was haunted. Redvenko hastened his steps. He wasn't a superstitious man. When you had power like his, there was no reason to fear what might lurk in the shadows. But who liked to walk by a graveyard? He burrowed deeper into his coat and made quick time down Havenstraat, keeping alert to the movements in every twisting alley. Soon he'd be back in Ravka, where he could stroll the streets without fear, assuming he got his pardon. Redvenko squirmed uncomfortably in his coat. The war had pitted Grisha against Grisha, and his side had been particularly brutal. He'd murdered former comrades, civilians, even children. But what was done could not be undone. King Nikolai needed soldiers, and Redvenko was a very good soldier. Redvenko nodded once to the guard stashed in the little booth at the entrance to Fourth Harbor and glanced over his shoulder, confirming he hadn't been followed. He made his way past the cargo containers to the docks, found the appropriate berth, and stood in line to register with the first mate. Redvenko recognized him from past voyages, always harried and ill-humored, scrawny neck poking from the collar of his coat. He held a thick sheaf of documents, and Redvenko glimpsed the purple wax seal of one of the members of the Kirch Merchant Council. Those seals were better than gold in this city, guaranteeing the best berths in the harbor and preferred access to the docks. And why did the councilmen garner such respect, such advantage? Because of coin. Because their missions brought profit to Ketterdam. Power meant something more in Ravka, where the elements bent to the will of the Grisha and the country was ruled by a proper king instead of a cadre of upstart merchants. Admittedly, Radvanko had tried to depose that king's father, but the point remained. "We're not ready for the rest of the crew just yet," the first mate said as Radvanko gave his name. "You can keep warm in the harbor master's office. We're waiting on our signal from the Council of Tides." "Good for you," Radvanko said, unimpressed. He glanced up at one of the black obelisk towers that loomed over the harbor. If there were any chance that the high and mighty Council of Tides could see him from their watchtower, he would have let them know exactly what he thought with a few choice gestures. They were supposedly Grisha, but had they ever lifted a finger to help the other Grisha in the city? To help those down on their luck who might have welcomed a bit of kindness?
"No, they have not," he answered himself.
The first mate winced.
"Gazen, Radvanko, have you been drinking?"
"No."
"You stink of whiskey."
Radvanko sniffed.
"Little bit whiskey."
"Just dry out. Get yourself some coffee or strong jerda. This cotton has to be in Jerholm in 2 weeks' time, and we aren't paying you to nurse a hangover below decks. Understood?"
"Yes, yes,"
Radvanko said with a dismissive wave, already heading toward the harbor master's office. But when he was a few steps away, he flicked his wrist. A tiny whirlwind caught the papers the first mate was holding, sending them flying over the docks.
"Damn it!"
he shouted as he went scrambling over the wooden planks, trying to capture the pages of his manifest before they blew into the sea. Radvanko smiled with grim pleasure, then felt a wave of sadness overtake him. He was a giant among men, a gifted squaller, a great soldier, but here he was just an employee, a sad old Ravkin who spoke broken curt and drank too much.
"Home," he told himself. "Soon I'll be home."
He would get his pardon and prove himself once more. He would fight for his country. He would sleep under a roof that didn't leak and wear a blue wool kefta lined with a silver fox fur. He would be Emil Radvanko again, not this pathetic shadow. "There's coffee," said the clerk when Radvanko entered the harbor master's office, gesturing toward a copper urn in the corner.
"Tea?"
"There's coffee."
"This country."
Radvanko filled a mug full of the dark sludge, more to warm his hands than anything. He couldn't bear the taste of it, certainly not without a healthy dose of sugar, which the harbor master had neglected to supply.
"Wind blowing in,"
said the clerk as a bell clanged outside, shaken by the rising breeze.
"I have ears," Radvanko grumbled.
"Don't think it will amount to much here, but once you get out of the harbor..."
"Be silent,"
Radvanko said sharply. He was on his feet, listening.
"What?"
said the clerk.
"There's..."
Radvanko put a finger to his lips.
"Someone cries out."
The sound had come from where the ship was docked.
"It's just gulls. Sun's coming up soon, and..."
Radvanko raised a hand, and a gust of air slammed the clerk back into the wall.
"I said be silent."
The clerk's mouth dropped open as he hung pinned to the slats.
"You're the Grisha they got for the crew?"
For saint's sake, was Radvanko going to have to pull the air from this boy's lungs and suffocate him into quiet? Through the waxy windows, Radvanko could see the sky beginning to turn blue as dawn arrived. He heard the squawking of gulls searching the waves for breakfast. Maybe the liquor was muddling his mind. Radvanko let the clerk drop to the ground. He'd spilled his coffee, but he didn't want to bother with another cup.
told you it was nothing, said the clerk as he dragged himself to his feet. Didn't have to get all heated up.
The clerk dusted himself off and got resettled behind the desk.
I never met one of you before, Grisha.
Redvenko snorted. The clerk probably had and simply didn't know it.
You get paid pretty good for the voyages?
Not good enough.
But whatever the clerk was going to say next was lost as the door to the office exploded in a hail of splinters. Redvenko's hands went up to shield his face. He ducked and rolled behind the clerk's desk for cover. A woman entered the office. Black hair, golden eyes. Shoo. The clerk reached for a shotgun Redvenko saw strapped beneath the desk.
They've come for the payroll, he shouted. Ain't no one taking the payroll.
Redvenko watched in shock as the gangly clerk stood like some kind of avenging warrior and opened fire. By all that was holy, nothing could motivate the Kerch like cash. Redvenko peeked around the desk in time to see the shotgun blast strike the woman directly in the chest. She was thrown backward and collided with the door jamb, crumpling to the floor. He smelled the sharp burn of gunpowder, the metallic tang of blood. Redvenko's belly gave a shaming lurch. It had been a long time since he'd seen someone shot down in front of him, and that had been in a time of war.
"Ain't no one taking the payroll,"
the clerk repeated with satisfaction. But before Redvenko could reply, the shoe woman wrapped her bloody hand around the doorframe, hauling herself to her feet. Redvenko blinked. Just how much whiskey had he had? The woman marched forward. Through the remains of her tattered blouse, Redvenko saw blood, flesh pocked with buckshot, and the glint of what looked like metal. The clerk fumbled to reload, but the woman was too fast. She grabbed the gun from his hands and swatted him down with it, knocking him sideways with terrible force. She tossed the gun aside and turned her golden eyes on Redvenko.
"Take payroll,"
Redvenko shouted, clambering backward. He dug in his pockets and tossed his nearly empty wallet at her.
"Take what you want."
The woman smiled slightly at that. With pity? Amusement? Redvenko did not know, but he understood that she had not come for the money at all. She had come for him, and it didn't matter if she was a slaver or a mercenary or something else entirely. She would face a soldier, not some cowering weakling. He leapt to his feet, muscles responding reluctantly to his demands, and shifted into fighting stance. His arms arced forward. A howling wind swept through the room, tossing a chair, then the clerk's desk, then the steaming coffee urn at the woman. She batted each item away with little interest, as if she were brushing aside stray cobwebs. Redvenko focused his power and shoved both his hands forward, feeling his ears pop as the pressure dropped and the wind swelled in a surging thunderhead. Maybe this woman couldn't be stopped by bullets. Let's see how she fared against the fury of a storm. The woman growled as the gale seized her, hurtling her back through the open doorway. She seized the jamb, trying to keep hold. Redvenko laughed. He'd forgotten how good it felt to fight. Then, from behind him, he heard a loud crack, the shriek of nails torn free and rending timber. He looked over his shoulder and caught the briefest glimpse of the dawn sky, the wharf. The wall was gone. Strong arms seized him, clasping his hands to his sides, preventing him from using his power. He was rising, sailing upward, the harbor shrinking beneath him. He saw the roof of the harbormaster's office, the body of the first mate in a heap on the dock, the ship Redvenko had been meant to sail on, its deck a mess of broken boards, bodies piled near the shattered masts. His attackers had been there first. The air was cold on his face. His heart pounded a ragged rhythm in his ears.
"Please,"
he begged as they soared higher, unsure of what he was pleading for. Afraid to move too suddenly or too much, he craned his neck to look at his captor. Redvenko released a terrified moan, somewhere between a sob and the panicked whine of an animal caught in a trap. The man holding him was Shu, his black hair pulled into a tight bun, his golden eyes narrowed against the rush of the wind, and from his back emerged two vast wings that beat against the sky, hinged, gracefully wrought in looping silver filigree and taut canvas. Was he an angel? A demon? Some strange mechanical come to life? Had Redvenko simply lost his mind? In the arms of his captor, Emil Redvenko saw the shadow they made cast upon the glittering surface of the sea far below. Two heads, two wings, four legs. He had become a great beast, and yet that beast would devour him. His prayers turned to screams, but both went unanswered.
2. Wylan. What am I doing here? That thought had run through Wylan's head at least 6 times a day since he'd met Kaz Brekker. But on a night like this, a night when they were working, it rose and fell in his head like a nervous tenor practicing his scales. What am I doing here? What am I doing here? What am I doing here? Wylan tugged at the hem of his sky-blue jacket, the uniform worn by the waiters of Club Cumulus, and tried to look at ease. Think of it as a dinner party, he told himself. He'd endured countless uncomfortable meals at his father's house. This was no different. In fact, it was easier. No awkward conversations about his studies or when he planned to start classes at the university. All he had to do was stay quiet, follow Kaz's instructions, and figure out what to do with his hands. Clasp them in front? Too much like a singer at a recital. In back? Too military. He tried just dangling them at his sides, but that didn't feel right either. Why hadn't he paid better attention to the way waiters stood? Despite Kaz's assurances that the second-floor parlor was theirs for the night, Wylan felt certain that at any minute a real member of the staff would enter the room, point at him, and shout, "Imposter!" Then again, Wylan felt like an imposter most days. It had been just under a week since they'd reached Ketterdam, almost a month since they'd left Jerholm. Wylan had been wearing Kuwei's features for most of that time, but whenever he caught a glimpse of his reflection in a mirror or a shop window, it took a long moment to realize he wasn't looking at a stranger. This was his face now, golden eyes, wide brow, black hair. His old self had been scrubbed away, and Wylan wasn't sure he knew the person who remained, the person who was standing in a private parlor in one of the Lid's most luxurious gambling dens, caught up in another of Kaz Brekker's schemes. A player at the table lifted his champagne glass for a refill, and Wylan darted forward from his perch against the wall. His hands were shaking as he took the bottle from the silver ice bucket, but there were some benefits to the years he'd spent at his father's social functions. He at least knew how to pour a proper glass of champagne without it foaming over. Wylan could almost hear Jesper's mocking voice. "Marketable skills, Merchling." He dared a glance at Jesper now. The sharpshooter was seated at the table, hunched over his cards. He wore a battered navy waistcoat embroidered with small gold stars, and his rumpled shirt shone white against his dark brown skin. Jesper rubbed a tired hand over his face. They'd been playing cards for more than 2 hours. Wylan couldn't tell if Jesper's fatigue was real or part of the act. Wylan filled another glass, focusing on Kaz's instructions.
"Just take the player's orders and keep one ear on Smeet's conversation," he'd said. "It's a job, Wylan. Get it done."
Why did they all call it a job? It didn't feel like working. It felt like missing a step and suddenly finding yourself falling. It felt like panic. So Weiland took stock of the room's details, a trick he'd often used to steady himself whenever he arrived someplace new or when his father was in a particularly foul mood. He inventoried the pattern of interlocking starbursts that formed the polished wood floor, the shell-shaped nodes of the blown glass chandelier, the cobalt silk wallpaper flocked with silver clouds. No windows to allow in natural light. Kaz said none of the gambling dens had them, because the bosses wanted players to lose track of time. Weiland watched Kaz deal another hand to Smeet, Jesper, and the other players at the round table. He wore the same sky-blue staff jacket as Weiland, and his hands were bare. Weiland had to fight not to stare at them. It wasn't just the strangeness, the wrongness of seeing Kaz without his gloves. It was that his hands seemed animated by a secret machinery Weiland didn't understand. When he had started to learn figure drawing, Weiland had studied anatomy illustrations. He had a good grasp of musculature, the way bones and joints and ligaments fit together. But Kaz's hands moved as if they'd been made for no other purpose than to manipulate cards, long white fingers flexing in easy rhythm, the shuffle precise, each turn economical. Kaz had claimed he could control any deck. So why was Jesper losing so badly? When Kaz had outlined this part of the plan at the hideout on Black Vale, Weiland had been incredulous, and for once, he hadn't been the only one with questions.
"Let me get this straight," Nina had said. "Your grand scheme is to give Jesper a line of credit and make him play cards with Cornelis Smeet?"
"Smeet likes high-stakes three-man bramble and blondes," said Kaz. "So we're going to give him both. I'll deal the first half of the night, then Specht will take over."
Weiland didn't know Specht well. He was a former Navy seaman, a member of the dregs who had piloted their ship to and from the ice court. If Weiland was honest, between the grizzled jaw and the tattoos that ran halfway up Specht's neck, he found the sailor slightly frightening. But even Specht had looked concerned when he said, "I can deal cards, Kaz, but I can't control a deck."
"You don't have to. From the time you sit down, it will be an honest game. The important thing is to keep Smeet at the tables until midnight. The shift change is when we risk losing him. As soon as I stand up, he's going to start thinking about moving on to another game or calling it a night. So you all need to do everything you can to keep his ass firmly planted at that table."
"I can handle it," Jesper said. Nina had just scowled.
"Sure. And maybe for phase two of this plan, I can masquerade as a Gerda Parum dealer. What could possibly go wrong?"
Weiland wouldn't have put it that way exactly, but he agreed, strongly. They should be keeping Jesper away from gambling dens, not encouraging his love of risk. But Kaz hadn't been moved.
"Just do your job, and keep Smeet thoroughly enthralled until midnight," he'd said. "You know what's on the line."
They all did. Inej's life. And how could Weiland argue with that? He felt a pang of guilt every time he thought about it. Van Eck had said he would give them 7 days to give up Ku Wei Yul Bo. Then he would begin torturing Inej. They were almost out of time. Weiland knew he couldn't have prevented his father from double-crossing the crew and kidnapping her. He knew that, but he still felt responsible.
"What am I supposed to do with Cornelis Smeet after midnight?" Nina asked.
"Try to talk him into spending the night with you."
"What?" Matthias had sputtered, red flooding his face all the way up to his ears.
"He won't say yes,"
Nina sniffed. Like hell he won't.
Nina, Matthias growled. Smeet never cheats at cards or on his wife, Kaz said. He's like half the amateurs strutting around the barrel. Most of the time he's respectable, scrupulous, strict economies and half a glass of wine at dinner. But once a week, he enjoys feeling like he's an outlaw matching wits with the high rollers on East Stave. And he likes a pretty blonde on his arm when he does it.
Nina pursed her lips. If he's so moral, then why do you want me to try to...
Because Smeet's rolling in coin, and any self-respecting girl from West Stave would at least make the effort.
I don't like this, said Matthias. Jesper had smiled his reckless gunslinger's grin. To be fair, Matthias, you don't like much.
Keep Smeet at Club Cumulus from 8 bells until midnight, Kaz said. That's 4 hours of play, so stay smart about it.
Nina was certainly doing her best, and Weiland didn't know whether to be impressed or concerned. She was dressed in a sheer lavender gown, rigged with some kind of corset that pushed her cleavage to alarming heights, and though she'd lost weight since her battle with Perrim, there was still plenty of her for Smeet to grab onto. She'd settled her rump firmly on his knee, arm around his shoulder, and was cooing prettily in his ear, her hands caressing his chest and occasionally slipping beneath his jacket like a beagle searching for treats. She stopped only to order oysters or another bottle of champagne. Weiland knew Nina could handle just about any man and any situation, but he didn't think she should have to sit half-dressed in a drafty gambling parlor perched on some leering lawyer's lap. At the very least, she was probably going to catch cold. Jesper folded yet again and blew out a long, exasperated breath. He'd been losing slowly for the last 2 hours. He'd kept his bids cautious, but neither Luck nor Kaz seemed to be on his side tonight. How were they supposed to keep Smeet at the table if Jesper ran out of funds? Would the other high-stakes players be enough of a lure? There were a few of them in the room, lingering by the walls, watching the game, each hoping to nab a seat if someone cashed out. None of them knew the real game Kaz was running. As Weiland leaned down to refill Nina's glass, he heard Smeet murmur, "A card game is like a duel. It's the little cuts and slashes that set the stage for the final killing stroke." He glanced across the table to Jesper. "That lad is bleeding all over the table."
"I don't know how you keep the rules straight in your head," Nina said with a giggle.
Smeet grinned, clearly pleased. "This is nothing compared to managing a business."
"I can't imagine how you do that either."
"Sometimes I don't know myself," Smeet said on a sigh. "It's been a hard week. One of my clerks never came back from his holiday, and that meant I was stuck short-handed."
Weiland nearly dropped the bottle he was holding. Champagne splashed onto the floor.
"I'm paying to drink it, not wear it, boy," snapped Smeet.
He wiped at his trousers and muttered, "That's what comes of hiring foreigners." "He means me," Weiland realized, as he backed away hurriedly. He didn't know how to make the reality of his new shoe features sink in. He couldn't even speak shoe, a fact that hadn't worried him until 2 shoe tourists with a map in hand had waylaid him on East Stave. Weiland had panicked, made an elaborate shrugging gesture, and bolted for the servant's entrance to Club Cumulus.
"Poor baby," Nina said to Smeet, running her fingers through his thinning hair and adjusting one of the flowers tucked into her silky blonde tresses. Wyland wasn't sure if she'd actually told Smeet she was from the House of the Blue Iris, but he certainly would have assumed so. Jesper leaned back in his seat, fingers tapping the handles of his revolvers. The movement seemed to draw Smeet's eye. "Those guns are remarkable. Real mother-of-pearl in the handles, if I'm not mistaken," Smeet said in the tones of a man who was rarely mistaken. "I have a fine collection of firearms myself, though nothing in the line of Zemini repeating revolvers."
"Oh, I'd love to see your guns," Nina cooed, and Wyland looked at the ceiling in an attempt to avoid rolling his eyes. "Are we going to sit here all night?"
Wyland tried to hide his confusion. Wasn't the whole point to get him to stay? But apparently Nina knew better, because Smeet's face took on a slightly mulish cast.
"Hush now. If I win big, I may buy you something pretty. I'll settle for some more oysters. You haven't finished those."
Wyland caught the quiver of Nina's nostrils and thought she might be drawing a fortifying breath. She'd had no appetite since she'd recovered from her bout with Parham, and he didn't know how she'd managed to slurp down nearly a dozen oysters. Now he watched her swallow the last of them with a shudder.
"Delicious," she managed with a glance at Wyland. "Let's have some more."
That was the signal. Wyland swooped in and picked up the big dish laden with ice and discarded shells.
"The lady has a craving," Smeet said.
"Oysters, miss?" Wyland asked. His voice sounded too high.
"Buttered prawns?"
Too low.
"She'll have both," said Smeet indulgently. "And another flute of champagne."
"Marvelous," Nina said, looking slightly green. Wyland rushed through the swinging door to the servants' pantry. It was stocked with plates, glassware, napkins, and a tin tub full of ice. A dumbwaiter took up a large section of the far wall, and there was a trumpet-shaped speaking tube next to it to allow the staff to communicate with the kitchen. Wyland set the dish of ice and shells on the table, then called down to the kitchen for oysters and buttered prawns.
"Oh, and another bottle of champagne."
"What vintage?"
More of the same?"
Wyland had heard his father's friends talk about which wines made for good investments, but he didn't quite trust himself to choose a year. By the time he returned to the parlor with Nina's order, Kaz was standing up from the table. He made a gesture as if he was dusting off his hands, the sign that a dealer had finished his shift. Specht sat down, a blue silk cravat tied at his throat to hide his tattoos. He shook out his cuffs and called for players to ante up or cash out. Kaz's eyes met Wyland's as he vanished into the pantry. This was the moment. According to Kaz and Jesper, a player often thought his luck was bound to the dealer and would stop play at the shift change. Wyland watched in distress as Smeet stretched and gave Nina's bottom a firm pat.
"We've had a good run," he said,
glancing at Jesper, who was staring dejectedly at his meager pile of remaining chips.
"We may find fatter game elsewhere."
"But my food just came," pouted Nina.
Wyland stepped forward, unsure of what to say, only knowing that they had to delay Smeet.
"Is everything to your liking, sir? Can I offer you and the lady something more?"
Smeet ignored him, hand still hovering over Nina's backside.
"There's finer victuals and better service to be had all over the lid, my dear."
A big man in a striped suit approached Smeet, eager to snag his seat.
"Cashing out?"
Smeet gave Jesper a friendly nod.
"Looks like we both are, eh, lad?
Better luck next time. Jesper didn't return the smile. I'm not done here. Smeet gestured to Jesper's sad stack of chips. Certainly looks like you are. Jesper rose and reached for his guns. Weiland clutched the bottle of champagne in his hands as the other players pushed back from the table, ready to grab their own weapons or dive for cover. But all Jesper did was unsling his gun belt. Gently, he laid the revolvers on the table, fingers brushing over their high gloss ridges with care. "How much for these?" he asked. Weiland tried to catch Jesper's eye. Was this part of the plan? And even if it was, what was Jesper thinking? He loved those guns. He might as well cut off his own hand and throw it into the pot. Specht cleared his throat and said, "The Cumulus isn't a pawn shop. We accept cash and credit from the Gemmons Bank only." "I'll stake you," Smeet said, with studied disinterest, "if it will get the game moving again. 1,000 krug for the guns? They're worth 10 times that. 5,000 krug. 7. 6. And that's only because I'm feeling generous." "Don't," Weiland blurted. The room went silent. Jesper's voice was cold. "I don't remember asking for your advice." "The insolence," said Smeet. "Since when do waiters involve themselves in gameplay?" Nina glared at Weiland, and Specht's tone was furious with disbelief when he said, "Gentlemen, shall we get this game rolling again? Ante up." Jesper shoved his revolvers across the table to Smeet, and Smeet slid a tall stack of chips over to Jesper in return. "All right," said Jesper, his gray eyes bleak. "Deal me in." Weiland stepped back from the table and disappeared into the pantry as quickly as he could. The dish of ice and shells was gone, and Kaz was waiting. He'd thrown a long orange cape over his blue jacket. His gloves were already back in place. "Kaz," Weiland said desperately, "Jesper just put his guns up."
"How much did he get for them?"
"Why does that matter? He..."
5,000 kruga?
6.
"Good. Not even Jesper should be able to run through that in less than 2 hours."
He tossed Weiland a cape and mask, the trappings of the Grey Imp, one of the characters of the Commedia Brute.
"Let's go."
"Me?"
"No, the idiot behind you."
Kaz picked up the speaking trumpet and said,
"Send up another waiter. This one managed to spill champagne on some high roller's shoes."
Someone in the kitchen laughed and said,
"You got it."
They were down the stairs and out the servants' entrance bare moments later, their costumes allowing them to move anonymously through the crowds of East Stave. "You knew Jesper would lose. You made sure of it," Weiland accused. Kaz rarely used his cane when they were roaming parts of the city where he might be recognized, but despite his lopsided gait, Weiland had to jog to keep up with him.
"Of course I did. I control the game, Weiland, or I don't play. I could have made sure Jesper won every hand."
"Then why?"
"We weren't there to win at cards. We needed Smeet to stay at the tables. He was ogling those guns almost as much as Nina's cleavage. Now he's feeling confident, like he's in for a good night. If he loses, he'll still keep playing. Who knows? Jesper may even win his revolvers back."
"I hope so," said Weiland, as they hopped onto a brow boat crowded with tourists and headed south down the Stave.
"You would."
"What's that supposed to mean?"
"Someone like Jesper wins 2 hands and starts to call it a streak. Eventually he loses, and that just leaves him hungrier for the next run of good luck. The house relies on it."
"Then why make him walk into a gambling den?" Weiland thought, but didn't say.
And why make Jesper give up something that meant so much to him? There had to be another way to keep Smeet playing. But those weren't even the right questions. The real question was why Jesper did it all without hesitating. Maybe he was still looking for Kaz's approval, hoping to earn back his favor after Jesper's slip had led them into the ambush at the docks that had nearly cost Inej her life. Or maybe Jesper wanted something more than forgiveness from Kaz. What am I doing here? Wylan wondered again. He found himself gnawing on his thumb and forced himself to stop. He was here for Inej. She'd saved their lives more than once, and he wasn't going to forget that. He was here because he desperately needed the money. And if there was another reason, a tall, lanky reason with a too strong taste for games of chance, he wasn't going to think about that right now. As soon as they made it to the outskirts of the barrel, Wylan and Kaz ditched their capes and sky blue jackets and wended their way east into the Zelver district. Matthias was waiting for them beneath a darkened doorway on Handel Canal.
All clear?
Kaz asked.
All clear, said the big Fjärden. The lights went out on the top floor of Smeet's house more than an hour ago, but I don't know if the servants are awake. He only has a daily maid and cook, Kaz said. He's too cheap for full-time servants. How is... Nina is fine. Jesper is fine. Everyone is fine, except for me, because I'm stuck with a gang of hand-wringing nursemaids. Keep a watch.
Wylan shrugged apologetically at Matthias, who looked like he was considering dashing Kaz's skull against a wall, then hurried along the cobblestones after Kaz. Smeet's home also served as his office, and it was located on a dark street with sparse foot traffic. The lamps were lit along the canal, and candles burned in some of the windows, but after 10 bells, most of the neighborhood's respectable citizens had already retired. "Are we just going in through the front door?"
"Use your eyes instead of running your mouth," said Kaz,
lockpicks already flashing in his gloved hands. "I am," Wylan thought, but that wasn't strictly true. He'd taken in the house's proportions, the pitch of its gabled roof, the roses beginning to bloom in its window boxes, but he hadn't looked at the house as a puzzle. With some frustration, Wylan could admit this was an easy solve. The Zelver district was prosperous, but not truly wealthy. A place for successful artisans, bookkeepers, and barristers. Though the houses were well built and tidy, with views of a wide canal, they were tightly packed together, and there were no grand gardens or private docks. To access the windows of the upper floors, he and Kaz would have had to break into a neighboring home and go through two sets of locks instead of one. Better to risk the front door, to simply act as if they had every right to be there, even if Kaz was carrying picks instead of keys. Use your eyes. But Wylan didn't like looking at the world the way Kaz did, and once they'd gotten their money, he'd never have to again. A bare second later, Kaz pressed down on the handle, and the door swung open. Immediately, Wylan heard the patter of paws, claws on hard wood, low snarls, as Smeet's pack of hounds rushed the door, white teeth flashing, growls rumbling deep in their chests. Before they could realize someone other than their master had come to call, Kaz pushed Smeet's whistle between his lips and blew. Nina had managed to slip it from the chain the lawyer always wore around his neck, then tucked it beneath an empty oyster shell for Wylan to whisk into the kitchen. There was no sound from the whistle, at least not one that Wylan could hear. It's not going to work, he thought, imagining those huge jaws tearing into his throat. but the dogs skittered to a halt, bumping into one another in a confused tangle. Kaz blew again, lips pursing in time with the pattern of a new command. The dogs quieted and flopped to the floor with a disgruntled whine. One even rolled over on its back.
"Now why can't people be this easily trained?" Kaz murmured as he crouched to oblige the dog with a belly rub, black-gloved fingers smoothing the short fur. "Close the door behind you."
Weiland did, and stood with his back pressed to it, keeping a wary eye on the pile of slavering hounds. The whole house smelled of dog, damp fur, oily hides, warm breath, moist with the stink of raw meat.
"Not fond of animals?"
Kaz asked. "I like dogs," Weiland said. "Just not when they're the size of bears." Weiland knew the real puzzle of Smeet's house had been a thorny one for Kaz to solve. Kaz could pick just about any lock and outthink any system of alarms, but he hadn't been able to come up with a simple way around Smeet's bloodthirsty hounds that wouldn't leave their plan exposed. During the day, the dogs were kept in a kennel, but at night they were given free run of the house while Smeet's family slept peacefully in the richly appointed rooms of the third floor. The staircase closed off by an iron gate. Smeet walked the dogs himself up and down the handle canal, trailing after them like a tubby sled in an expensive hat. Nina had suggested drugging the dogs' food. Smeet went to the butcher every morning to select cuts of meat for the pack, and it would have been easy enough to switch the parcels. But Smeet wanted his dogs hungry at night, so he fed them in the mornings. He would have noticed if his prized pets had been sluggish all day, and they couldn't risk Smeet staying home to care for his hounds. He had to spend the evening on East Stave, and when he returned home, it was essential that he find nothing amiss. Inej's life depended upon it. Kaz had arranged for the private parlor in the cumulus. Nina had caressed the whistle from beneath Smeet's shirt, and piece by piece, the plan had come together. Weiland did not want to think about what they'd done to obtain the whistle commands. He shivered when he remembered what Smeet had said. "One of my clerks never came back from his holiday." He never would. Weiland could still hear the clerk screaming as Kaz dangled him by the ankles from the top of the Hanrat Point lighthouse. "I'm a good man," he'd shouted. "I'm a good man." They were the last words he'd spoken. If he'd talked less, he might have lived. Now, Weiland watched Kaz give the drooling dog a scratch behind the ears and rise.
"Let's go. Watch your feet."
They sidestepped the pile of dog bodies in the hall and made their way quietly up the stairs. The layout of Smeet's house was familiar to Weiland. Most businesses in the city followed the same plan. A kitchen and public rooms for meeting with clients on the ground floor, offices and storage on the second floor, sleeping rooms for the family on the third floor. Very wealthy homes had a fourth floor for servants' quarters. As a boy, Weiland had spent more than a few hours hiding from his father in his own home's upper rooms.
"Not even locked," Kaz murmured as they entered Smeet's office. "Those hounds have made him lazy."
Kaz closed the door and lit a lamp, turning the flame down low. The office had three small desks arranged by the windows to take advantage of the natural light, one for Smeet and two for his clerks.
"I'm a good man."
Weiland shook off the memory and focused on the shelves that ran from floor to ceiling. They were lined with ledgers and boxes full of documents, each carefully labeled with what Weiland assumed were the names of clients and companies.
"So many pigeons," Kaz murmured, eyes scanning the boxes. "Nathan Boreg, that sad little skiv Carl Dryden. Smeet represents half the merchant council,
including Weiland's father." Smeet had served as Jan Van Eck's attorney and property manager for as long as Weiland could remember.
"Where do we start?"
Weiland whispered. Kaz pulled a fat ledger from the shelves.
"First, we make sure your father has no new acquisitions under his name. Then, we search under your stepmother's name and yours."
"Don't call her that. Alice is barely older than I am, and my father won't have kept property in my name."
"You'd be surprised at what a man will do to avoid paying taxes."
They spent the better part of the next hour digging through Smeet's files. They knew all about Van Eck's public properties, the factories, hotels, and manufacturing plants, the shipyard, the country house, and farmland in southern Kerch. But Kaz believed Weiland's father had to have private holdings, places he'd kept off the public registers, places he'd stash something or someone he didn't want found. Kaz read names and ledger entries aloud, asking Weiland questions and trying to find connections to properties or companies they hadn't yet discovered. Weiland knew he owed his father nothing, but it still felt like a betrayal.
"Geldspin?"
asked Kaz. "A cotton mill. I think it's in Zierfort."
"Too far. He won't be keeping her there. What about Firma Allerbest?"
Weiland searched his memory. "I think that one's a cannery."
"They're both practically printing cash, and they're both in Alice's name. But Van Eck keeps the big earners to himself, the shipyard, the silos at Sweet Reef."
"I told you," Weiland said, fiddling with a pen on one of the blotters. "My father trusts himself first, Alice only so far. He wouldn't leave anything in my name." Kaz just said,
"Next ledger. Let's start with the commercial properties."
Weiland stopped fiddling with the pen. "Was there something in my name?" Kaz leaned back. His look was almost challenging when he said,
"A printing press."
The same old joke. So why did it still sting? Weiland set the pen down. "I see.
He's not what I would call a subtle man. Isle Comédier is in your name, too."
"Of course it is," Weiland replied, wishing he sounded less bitter. Another private laugh for his father to enjoy. An abandoned island with nothing on it but a broken-down amusement park, a worthless place for his worthless, illiterate son. He shouldn't have asked. As the minutes ticked away and Kaz continued reading aloud, Weiland became increasingly agitated. If he could just read, they'd be moving twice as fast through the files. In fact, Weiland would already know his father's business inside out. "I'm slowing you down," he said. Kaz flipped open another sheaf of documents.
"I knew exactly how long this would take. What was your mother's family name?"
"There's nothing in her name."
"Humor me."
"Hendricks." Kaz walked to the shelves and selected another ledger.
"When did she die?"
"When I was 8. Weiland picked up the pen again. "My father got worse after she was gone. At least, that was how Weiland remembered it. The months after his mother's death were a blur of sadness and silence. He wouldn't let me go to her funeral. I don't even know where she's buried." "Why do you guys say that, anyway? No mourners, no funerals. Why not just say good luck or be safe?"
"We like to keep our expectations low."
Kaz's gloved finger trailed down a column of numbers and stopped. His eyes moved back and forth between the two ledgers, then he snapped the leather covers shut.
Let's go.
Did you find something? Kaz nodded once.
I know where she is.
Weiland didn't think. He imagined the tension in the rasp of Kaz's voice. Kaz never yelled the way Weiland's father did, but Weiland had learned to listen for that low note, that bit of black harmony that crept into Kaz's tone when things were about to get